From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in New York City on New Year's Eve. The Manhattan District Attorney and the New York Police Department made repeated public demonstrations about the strict gun laws for the city. And they wanted to be clear. Thousands of people could cram into New York City safely without fearing that lots of partiers would be carrying guns around. This is the scenario most often discussed by opponents of new gun legislation known as concealed carry reciprocity. Here's the basic outline. Individual states have their own laws regarding concealed carry of firearms. If you live in a state with fewer restrictions and you travel to a state with tighter restrictions, you might be breaking a law even unknowingly. And the NRA has long said that puts law-abiding citizens at risk of being criminalized, even when they're not really doing anything wrong. The solution, they say, is a national law that says states with stricter gun laws have to honor out-of-state permits from states with different laws. What's wrong with that? Well, those who are concerned about this issue point to the New Year's Eve thing. They say in recent days, just listen to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the NYPD saying that if concealed carry reciprocity passes, they cannot impose restrictions on guns in Times Square on New Year's Eve, provided there is a legal permit from another state or the carrier is from a no-permit state. But the NRA says this misses the point of the legislation and our rights should not stop at state lines. So let's talk about that. Paul Simonelli is here, managing member of the Simonelli & Simonelli Law Firm and handled many cases regarding gun rights. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Charon Sattler LeBlanc is here. She is local chapter leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Charon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gary Putup is a representative of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Gary, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And this is a kind of, I want to be clear here, we reached out to I think five or six different people on both sides of this. And the people in studio are the ones who are available. I told Paul before the hour began, Charon and Gary have very different views, but Paul will certainly deserves equal time, and we'll make sure that this isn't sort of a ganging up on. And Paul can handle it.
I can handle it.
Well, thank you for being here, Paul. What I want to do is start with asking all three of you, if we're framing the issue correctly here, which is this, concealed carry reciprocity is just a term that talks about what the law says about permit holders from other states. So, Paul, fair to say, 50 states, different rules state to state when it comes to concealed carry, and that the NRA's point that, look, it can be confusing and you don't want to criminalize someone simply for crossing a state line. Is that the basic outline or is there more to it here?
I think there's more to it. Okay. I think you have to understand that right now, this Reciprocity Act only will directly affect about 12 states. Right now, I am legal. I can carry a concealed firearm in 38 states. I can't carry it in D.C., so it's 12 states in D.C., 12 or 13 states in D.C. that I can't carry concealed in based on those state laws. Many states recognize New York's pistol permit law, and with a combination of some out-of-state or non-resident permits from other states, you're pretty much covered in most of the country except for those 12.
That's a lot of states, though.
That is.
You're kind of acting like it's like one state or one town. 12 states.
Well, 12 states, right? And I think the concern is, I'll give you an example. If I'm driving from here to Florida, I get on 81, and I'm good in New York, I'm good in Pennsylvania. I drive 12 miles through Maryland on 81, and I'm committing a felony at that moment, for those 12 minutes I'm driving through Maryland. And then again, I don't have an issue till I get near South Carolina. And driving through South Carolina, I have a problem. And then otherwise, I arrive in Florida, and I'm perfectly okay. So I understand it does create some strange results for people. People land at Newark Airport, legally carrying a gun on an airplane in their luggage. Their next flight gets canceled. They're required to pick up their luggage. The airlines won't keep it overnight. Now they're committing a felony in in New Jersey because they're not allowed to have the firearm in New Jersey. So you get some strange results, unintended consequences by not having some sort of reciprocity throughout all the states.
All right, so what you're describing is unintended consequences of a law, even with good intentions. You're driving from New York to Florida or inbound passengers. That's a little different than the argument that says, you know, if you're a concealed carry gun owner in any of those 38 states and you don't know and you cross the state line, you know, on even a short trip, let's say you live near a border, that It's unfair to you. And my question for you at that point is, isn't personal responsibility in play? Don't you at least need to know what the law says?
Absolutely. While we have all these laws, it's your responsibility to know them and to follow them. But once again, we find people, very simple things, driving a snowmobile on federal forest. You know, you could have state land next to it. You could accidentally, you know, go 50 yards onto federal and be committing a misdemeanor. So there's opportunities. You could be driving on a highway in Arizona and driving through a piece of highway that is an Indian reservation. And the laws are different on that reservation than they are in the rest of the state of Arizona. You get a flat tire and pull off the road to change it. Potentially you're committing a felony in Arizona because you're stopping on this Indian land with a firearm, a concealed firearm. So there's lots of opportunities where but you're absolutely right. People need to be responsible for their actions and need to know what the laws are if they're going to assume that responsibility.
Okay. Taryn, your thoughts on concealed carry reciprocity?
Well, it is a complicated issue. And I think one of the things we need to think about is why do we have the laws that are passed state by state? And what we're really, the difference is state by state is dictating who should be permitted to conceal and carry. And I think what the challenge is when we're looking at reciprocity, what one state might dictate who can carry may be very different than what another state can carry. So, for example, you know, we're next to states which do not necessarily have any permit required to carry. And what concealed carry reciprocity would mean for the state of New York is it would bring the law to the lowest common denominator, which effectively would dismiss what New York State has decided who can carry. So that's, I think, one of the big concerns that we have nationally is that this is a state right and that states have determined what's appropriate for their regions. They're the people who live there. They know the culture of their states, and they're in the best position, and this would effectively undermine that.
Okay. Gary Pettup.
Well, I think to build a little bit on what Sharon was saying is simply the and what Paul brought up is this is a matter of sovereignty. I'm not going to be in a position, Paul, to tell other states what they should and shouldn't do. Paul mentioned the idea that you could be driving through Arizona and accidentally go on Indian land, and I don't know that we refer to it as Indian land anymore. They are sovereign nations ruled and governed by Native Americans. And I'm not sure today that we want to be telling Native Americans what they can and cannot do on their sovereign land. In addition to that, it's not clear to me that, you know, under our federalist system, that states, and some of these states have no laws at all covering concealed carry. And, you know, what Paul talks about is somebody that accidentally is at Newark Airport or may fly into, let's make it home, so fly into Rochester. And they have a gun and they get their flights canceled. Well, first of all, there's an exception in New York state law and our penal law that covers those circumstances. And if that gun is able to be transported by TSA, which it requires to be in a locked, opaque case, that would meet the exception in New York state law. So that's really that's not an issue.
Driving to Florida? He raised a question. I mean, 12 miles in Maryland. Yeah, and all of a sudden, you're committing a felony.
Yeah, I've been on 81. I know it's dark and dangerous, and I am being sarcastic.
Come on, he's not saying it's dark and dangerous. He's saying
he's saying for those 12 miles, you become committing
a felony?
No. So if you have a firearm and you're traveling to Florida, and as Paul said, you know, he has a Florida permit. Many people here do. Florida has different laws. And as you said, you have to know the other state's laws. If Florida allows you to carry a firearm, and we can make it even closer, like Vermont with no permit at all, all you have to do is the same thing you can do in New York. You put it in an opaque locked case, you throw it in the back of the car, and you're all set. You know, this seems to think like every time that there's a law, you know, we take this hardest case as if somebody's going to go to prison because they happen to be traveling through 12 miles of Maryland. And, you know, these types of cases really, you know, don't exist. Where the real danger is, from my perspective, and I know Jerron's going to talk more about domestic violence, and that's certainly clearly an issue. My real problem with H.R. 38, this concealed carry reciprocity law, is that people can carry a gun here based on their state laws. And it's not a decision we're making. But here's the real kicker, that a police officer cannot question that. Now, we have 6 to 12 states, depending on how you interpret their laws, that are engaged, they have what's called constitutional carry. In fact, one of them is Vermont. If you go to the state attorney general's website, you can see where the crime guns come in through New York, come into New York State. Many of them are from the South, and about a third of them come up through Vermont because they have very loose gun laws. Now, in Vermont, you don't need a pistol permit to carry concealed. You have what they call constitutional carry. Literally, the way this law is written, if a police officer in Rochester stops someone and he says, I live in Vermont, here's my copy of the Constitution, you cannot ask me any more questions about my right to carry a gun. You cannot call Vermont and ask if I'm legal to carry this. It's actually forbidden in this section. And that man is on his way.
All right, so that is goes to what Chiron is saying, is the states with the lightest restrictions or the least number of restrictions, it becomes sort of a national law.
Because that's exactly what happens.
Is that wrong, Paul?
Well, let me try to draw a comparison for you. I think this legislation's flawed for multiple reasons, but the idea of it, I'm not opposed to. But let me give you a scenario here, talking about domestic violence. You know, we have something called full faith and credit. We have to follow a domestic order of protection that's done in another state. Federal law actually disqualifies someone who has been convicted of a domestic offense. Also, federal law disqualifies anyone based on any state law for where that person lives that disqualifies them. In New York, we call it serious offenses, but some of them aren't very serious. I can give you an example, but for some, you know, specific offenses that are crimes in New York that are on what's called the serious offense list, so you'd be disqualified. So there are issues. I think the legislation is flawed. I think the underlying reasoning for it is a valid reason, and I think it's a problem for people that travel that want to exercise their rights. But as it sits right now, Gary, I'm going to agree with you. There's problems with it, I think, constitutionally and otherwise, and it needs to be fixed. And that's why I don't think, even if it does somehow got through the Senate, I don't believe that it would withstand a court challenge.
Okay, so a couple of things here. And I know Chiron's going to want to talk, because we've talked a little bit about domestic violence. And I know that's something that is very important to her. But let me just hit a couple of other points, because I have some emails already to work through. Number one, Sherry emails the program and says, the guest in favor of concealed carry reciprocity just described several scenarios in travel. Does he have any data on how many people have been arrested under these seemingly unlikely situations? And can we compare that to how many people are killed in mass shootings? We should weigh out the greater risk. Now, Paul's got views on mass shootings, causes, effects, which I know is related, but it's separate to this. Let's just stick with the first part of Sherry's question, Paul. You raise this issue of someone driving south and all of a sudden you're going through a few miles of Maryland and you're committing a felony. Are people actually getting arrested for that?
Well, there are. I can think of three cases in the last 2 years. One in New Jersey and
three.
Yes,
total.
Well, all right, yeah, but these are the ones that I saw written
about.
Fair enough. I don't have statistics, but it does happen. And how many of us have taken the wrong exit on a unfamiliar? I used to live outside Philadelphia. I know how easy it is to end up on the Ben Franklin Bridge.
Yeah, it's the worst.
And end up in Camden, New Jersey.
Yeah,
and so, and it does happen, and it happens around Washington, D.C. It happens around any place where there's an extensive road network.
Yep.
It's very easy to end up across a state line. You know, we saw a soldier that ended up in Mexico by getting in the wrong line, and he ended up being held in Mexico.
Question, though, is are people actually getting arrested for this?
Yes, and in fact, Chris Christie, when he was still running for president during the last election, made a big deal about, about setting aside convictions for some folks that had been caught up in that ended up in Camden, New Jersey, or across the wrong bridge at the wrong time. And there's two other ones, and I can't think of the states they were in, but I was just recently reading there were two other circumstances where this happened to people. So you're right. And those are the ones that I read about. I don't know what the numbers are.
Okay.
But let me just step back for 1 second and say, you know, when we talk about people that conceal carry legally, that possess firearms legally, the statistics are very clear that 1/6 of the people that carry, there's 6 times more police officers being arrested and convicted of crimes than there are concealed carry folks involving crimes involving firearms.
Okay, so on that point, Paul, when people invoke New Year's Eve, New York City, the NRA tends to say, look, you may not like to hear this, but people who concealed carry are responsible, they're well-trained, they respect the laws, they're not the ones you have to worry about in New Year's Eve anyway. Is that your response as well to New Year's Eve?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And God forbid, you know, we've seen the targets, people have become targets where people aren't allowed to have any sort of firearms. And, you know, this is a discussion for another day, but the reality is bad people go after soft targets. They don't go after hard targets.
I don't think it's a discussion for another day, and here's why. I understand the point that you're making there, but you're also sort of implying that on New Year's Eve, if someone starts shooting, you want concealed carry people in the crowd. I don't want anybody in the crowd of a million people just with a gun to pull out and start looking for a target and start firing. Isn't that going to be more chaos? And on top of that, and I think probably Chiron will talk a little bit about this, the counterpoint I often hear is this. When there are guns present and when there is alcohol present and other substances present and things escalate and people are in close quarters, a million people on New Year's Eve, I know that people who concealed carry generally and very generally, almost always, respect the law, understand the law, are well-trained. But you want them carrying a gun in a huge crowd when things kind of go south in when someone's been drinking? That's another part of the argument. Do you disagree?
I'm not opposed to that if they're acting responsibly. I really have no problem at all. If I choose to carry my gun, I know what the laws are in New York relating to alcohol. I also know what my tolerance is for alcohol. And if I choose to carry a gun, I will act accordingly. We had this incident 2 years ago here in Rochester on Christmas Eve, possible terrorist attack. And I typically don't go out for New Year's Eve, but I had plans to go out in the city of Rochester that night. And I did go out, and I was responsible in my actions and how I comported myself that evening, because I wanted to make sure that the people that were around me that I cared about were protected. So that's just an individual decision. I don't have a problem with it. If people act irresponsibly, then they deserve to, whatever should happen to them.
Okay, Chiron,
and I know you want to ask Chiron, but Ivan, if I may, just before we go on, and we keep bringing up well-trained, and no offense, I know you know, but there's no training at all to get a pistol permit, to get a carry permit.
No, I think the point the NRA tends to make, though, is people who have concealed carry tend to be people who are, I think the NRA's wider point is gun owners are respectful people, they're responsible, they, whether they're required to or not, tend to be well-trained.
Well, that's the part I'm going to challenge. I don't know what the NRA is saying, but the fact of the matter, there is no training at all required for this. And this is one of the problems with concealed carry. In fact, even in Monroe County, the training consists of nothing. You can go to Monroe County, you can get a pistol permit, never receive any training. You don't even need to own a gun. You can go buy a gun a year later, never shoot the thing, never get any training, and carry it. And this is the same way, like in Vermont. Again, let's do our neighbor state, Vermont. There's no training required. This whole idea that they're well-trained, I mean, we can say all these other things, but I think it's important for the audience and for people to know, the public to know. The NRA can say these people are well-trained. There is no training. There's no training requirement at all.
All right, Chiron, go ahead.
So I just want to acknowledge, hopefully our listeners are also hearing, there's a lot that we agree on. And certainly as Paul speaks to responsible gun owners, absolutely. And I think that's what we want to talk about, is how do we make sure that those who are owning and, you know, using firearms are responsible. The challenge we have is that there are a lot of problems nationally with our laws and policies. Certainly, there's federal guidelines and federal laws about who can purchase a firearm. But what is it? 40% of all firearm sales do not involve a background check. Is that about right?
In New York, every firearm transfer involves?
There are actually many states that have universal background checks, and that's one of the things that we're working for. A lot of the volunteers in the gun violence prevention movement are working towards universal background checks. But the reality is about 40% of all guns that are sold each year are transferred privately, and the internet has made that a lot easier. Things like Craigslist, transfers between family members. And that creates a loophole. And so that creates, you know, how do we know who's responsible in that population to carry? And when you have states that have different levels and different ways that they manage conceal carry, you have this whole group who may be carrying who kind of fall outside of all of that. So that's a big concern.
Okay. And I also want to ask you, Tarun, can you address the ideas of sort of interpersonal violence? And, you know, Paul's raising the point that says he's a gun owner. He knows what the rules are. He understands his own alcohol limits. He is going to follow that. He's going to trust other gun owners to do the same. And that, you know, largely he believes the numbers that indicate that people do that. So when it comes to whether it's domestic violence or interpersonal violence, what are your views on, you know, sort of Paul's statements there, that for the most part, gun owners are pretty well controlled and understand exactly what their limits are?
Well, sure. So I'll share a little bit of my backstory. So I came to this movement probably in 1990. I lost my cousin, who was 23 years of age, and her 5-year-old daughter to domestic violence. She had left her relationship. Her ex-boyfriend knew that she was never going to come back. I believe what we know about what happened that night is I think she was trying to maintain the relationship, had made dinner for the family, and he had purchased a gun for the one purpose. And first he killed their daughter, he killed my cousin, and then he committed suicide. So while we talk about gun violence in the United States, there's a lot of ways we talk about gun violence. You know, we certainly have a lot of attention that's brought to the topic by the mass shootings, which are increasing in number to the point where it's hard to keep them straight anymore. But we recognize that mass shootings are happening every day, and over half of them have a domestic component. Over 54% of all of the mass shootings, and many of them never make the news because for, you know, one of the common definitions is where 4 or more people die as a result, not including the shooter. So when I hear about gun violence in the United States, I don't necessarily think as much about, from my experience, the stranger. I'm more concerned about someone that I know and trust and someone not using that gun appropriately. I think, you know, one of the most dangerous times for people in abusive relationships is when they leave. And, you know, anyone who works in domestic violence knows that's a very high-risk time. And everyone's nodding around the table. There's no argument. Because ending a relationship is one of the most painful things that any of us will experience. And if you have, you know, and that's why this stuff is so important, is that we need to know that the people who have firearms are the right people who are responsible or are going to handle it appropriately. And if they do exhibit behavior that demonstrates that they shouldn't, that we should have ways that they no longer carry them. The big thing that I think all of us agree on is we want to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people.
Okay. Paul, some thoughts on that?
Sure. And obviously, your basic premise is spot on. We don't want people that shouldn't have firearms to have firearms. If you look at the growth of ownership of firearms in the country, right now, the growth with women, for instance, is, I think, 2 or 3 times that of more women are buying guns than men as a percentage of the population. If you look at minority populations, I think the number that's at the highest point are African-American women are purchasing firearms in this country. We see people doing what they need to do to protect themselves, not only from domestic incidents, but also from the threats that we face in society, and taking responsibility for protecting themselves rather than relying on the system, the response time of local law enforcement or other things. And so I completely understand and empathetic with the need to keep the guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them. But those people are readily identifiable for the most part. And and I can only use this state because I'm here in this state, I see what happens on a pretty regular basis here when people do break up. I see that one of the first thing that happens, if there's any indication at all that there might be a problem, judges here are very liberal in giving out domestic orders of protection, which result in the seizure or the surrendering of all firearms by the person named in that protection order. And it's quite an effort for them to get them back, so much so that many times, you know, like I said, for a very low standard, people end up losing all their firearms for a period of time, and they end up having to engage attorneys like the folks at my firm to help them secure them back after the situation has resolved itself. So I don't know that the laws are lacking. And the one thing that we always assume with laws is that the laws are going to make a difference for unlawful people. And the laws don't affect unlawful people other than when they get prosecuted. And so more laws on the books are limiting people's rights so that we can hopefully protect people doesn't seem to have much of an effect on those that are going to be lawless.
All right, so I want to go ahead and grab Elizabeth in Fairport's phone call because she's raising a question that I think goes to some of what Paul Simonelli just said. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi. You don't know that any person is a law-abiding gun owner with training. You don't know that. We don't have anything that tells me or makes me feel confident. Most women do not talk about the violence that goes on. Most women are under threat of violence. There's a gun in the house. They don't do anything. They have children. They don't have alternatives. They're scared. You let these gun laws get a little bit more flexible going from state to state, having each state give up its state's rights, which, I'm sorry, Republicans like to say all the time that let the states figure it out. You're making it even harder easier for these people who we don't have any sense. They're law-abiding citizens, as far as you can see. We don't know. How statistically do we really know the guys that did all of these mass shootings or killing their wives and girlfriends? How many people said, well, I never saw that coming?
If I can help, and Elizabeth is, I think, is absolutely correct. And one of the things that I know Jaron can also address is that so many of these mass shootings have domestic violence at their core. I just brought up from the Washington Post an article from 2 years ago, so obviously the numbers have increased, but people with concealed carry permits committed at least 29 of the mass shootings in the year 2007. And we see the same thing, and I know Sharon has better numbers on this than I do, but it is not unusual. In fact, it's very typically the case that these mass shootings have some element of domestic violence at their core. And I think that was the last one that was in Texas where the man walked into the church and shot all those people. It was the Air Force veteran. That was domestic violence related. And I think that, and if I could just real quick, because, and that goes back to Paul's point about the soft targets. And actually, when we study these mass shootings, when we make the connection that Elizabeth has to domestic violence, it's not the fact that they're soft shootings or soft targets. It's that they had some connection to the act of domestic violence or the act of harassment that led to the shooting in the first place.
So let me ask both of our other guests about this. While acknowledging that when we talk about mass shootings, sometimes we get an image in our head of Las Vegas or Orlando. Again, as Jaron said, mass shootings tend to be grouped in four deaths or more to single incident. So they're not all the same scenarios. And when Paul makes the point that if you pass a law, it's going to only impact the prosecution post-fact, but not be preventative, I think I understand when Paul is pointing to the Wes Webster Christmas Eve kind of thing. I understand that may be no way to stop someone who wants to do harm in certain moments. I also understand, and Chiron, I'll ask you about this, and I know Paul will have time to respond. I'm also thinking about the concern that it's not just people who have an intention to do harm in a mass shooting, and a nightclub. It's putting more firearms into the mix when there is volatility, or lessening laws or lessening states' abilities to govern what is allowed to be there when moments may be volatile and what the resulting action may be. So why don't you start by responding to Paul, and we'll give him some time to kind of weigh in as well, because Paul's saying, you know, the laws impact prosecution, but they're not preventative.
And thank you. We know, you know, the work that we do in the gun violence prevention movement with Moms, Everytown, Brady, Giffords is evidence-based. We use data, and we know that states that have laws in place have an impact on outcomes. We know this. For example, just even looking at background checks, New York State one of the states that requires a background check on every sale? Is that right?
Since the SAFE Act.
Okay. So, and I'm just checking the Giffords Law Center site. Mass shooting incidents are 52% fewer in states that have the background check requirement. I'm 63% fewer mass shootings by individuals who are prohibited from possessing guns, and 64% fewer mass shootings involving domestic violence. So there's a lot of statistics out there, and that's a lot of the work that we're trying to do. Gun violence is a public health issue. You know, as I said earlier, there's many ways that we come at the issues of gun violence in the United States, but we are the most industrialized country in the one of the most industrialized countries in the world, and yet we have such high levels of violence. You know, recently we talked about how the opioid epidemic is taking over 90 lives a day. The number today that we're quoting is 96 lives a day are lost to gun violence. And we're not talking about it as a public health emergency yet.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics is out with a statement urging the U.S. Senate to reject concealed carry reciprocity. Under this basis, quoting from the American Academy of Pediatrics, research shows that easier access to firearms increases the risk that children and youth will be injured or killed by guns. Making the concealed carry of firearms easier is a threat to children's safety, end quote. All right, so Paul, a lot to respond to. Go ahead there, and then what we're going to do, I want you to know, listeners, if you're on the phone, we've got the phone lines filled up now. I want to hear from our listeners, so let me let Paul Simonelli respond to some of what we just heard, and then we're going to get to your phone calls. Go ahead, Paul.
All right. Thank you. There is a lot of research out there. There isn't a lot of peer-reviewed research out there. And unfortunately, many of the things you mentioned, Brady and some of the other places that publish a lot of information, it really wouldn't, and you're an academic, you're in the academic world, it wouldn't stand up to the rigors of academic review because it's just not done well. So I'm very cautious about whenever we start throwing statistics out.
And Paul, can you speak to why that data is so difficult to get and why that makes the research difficult?
Well, I don't know. I'll only look at data that's peer-reviewed. So I was going to quote a couple of peer-reviewed studies that are out there.
And I think that's what a lot of us are advocating for, is that we have things in place nationally that make it very difficult to collect data. The gun lobby has made it difficult even for doctors in the state of Florida to talk to families about, do you have a gun in the home? For a while, they couldn't do that. Just a few years ago, that was finally lifted. So that's the challenge. Even when we're looking at how we're tracking data, even as we look at our state attorney general trying to track and get a sense of what's happening in our own state and the impact of, you know, other states along the Iron Pipeline, it is hard to get the data. And a lot of that, and I'd really encourage your listeners to take a little time to kind of look back in that, a lot of it has to do with the gun lobby and the ways that data is maintained. So I agree with you, Paul, that we do need better data. But there's some factors that are in the way that are making it difficult. But there's a lot of information out there that people are able to do very good analysis on.
If I could, and I agree with Paul, too. Because one of the reasons is in
keep
this
it brief,
legislative
Gary, because Paul yep. deserves more
in
time
this,
on this.
In this legislative session, one of the things that we have been working on getting passed is research funds through the SUNY schools, through our SUNY system, to be able to study gun violence, which is, as Sharon's pointed out, is now prohibited by federal law. But we can do that. Let's get the data. And I would hope that SCOPE and NRAs and other organizations would be supportive of that. Because until we know the data, if that's the case, then let's get it and let's be supportive of getting this done in New York.
Paul, go ahead.
Well, right. And I'll just quote one study here by Thomas Lott, who has had his work reviewed quite significantly and found to be standing up to the rigorous academic standards. And one of the things he found is that, for instance, in states that don't require a permit, that the murder rate was 31% lower and the violent crime rate was 28% lower than states that have requirements for concealed carry permits. Now, obviously, there can be a lot of factors that factor into that, where those states are, the number of, the size of urban areas. But it seems that repeatedly we find that as more people lawfully possess firearms, the areas where more people lawfully possess firearms, the rates go down. When we talk about gun violence, you can very easily lump all those numbers together and come up with your whatever number you came up with. But once again, we have to look at what is the nature of what you're calling gun violence. Was it someone committing suicide? Would that person's would the result have changed had they not had immediate access to a firearm? I don't know. I don't know that that's the case. If you take suicides
definitely. There's plenty of suicides that aren't completed if a gun's not available, right?
Well,
you can at least agree with that, right?
That if a gun isn't available.
If someone has the intention of dying by suicide and doesn't have access to a gun or does,
I don't know.
Much more likely going to die if there's a gun there. Yes or no?
I don't know.
I
don't know that. What's the basis for that?
Paul, I can tell you this, if I might, and to support what Evan's saying, is there are I believe 6 states now that have what's called an emergency restraining protection order, which we are fighting for in this legislative session, which would allow family and friends of loved ones who are in a time of crisis, suicidal, to be able to prevent their having access to guns. In the states that did that, they saw immediate drastic drops in successful suicide rates. And if I could, and I challenge the listening audience, when you referred to Lott's work and peer-reviewed, I would ask everybody, you could just go to Google, put in John Lott, Tom Lott, peer review, and see what the answer is. When he submitted his work for peer review, it was found to be flawed and inaccurate. I mean, I could go with a lot of peer-reviewed stuff. I hope we get that through our SUNY system, but Lott isn't one of them.
Okay, look, I've got to get a chance to get our listeners in because there's a lot of people who want to weigh in, and let me just try to work through as many as I can. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Yes, hi. I mean, I got some opinions on this gun issue, but I'll just tell you, I came back from a visiting my daughter and son-in-law in Texas. I got back at the end of December, and while I was there, I confiscated the weapon. My daughter begged me to talk my son-in-law out of going over to his sister's to stand up for her because she was putting up with some emotional verbal abuse from her husband. I spoke to him. I said, well, you know, they've been drinking. My daughter and son-in-law had been drinking heavily. And I said, well, first of all, you're in no shape to drive. And second of all, when you get there, what are you going to do? You're not a third party. You're not in any shape to, you know, help your sister. And then I found out that he had a weapon on him. I took it. I just said, oh, I don't think so. I grabbed the gun. And I said, I'll just hang on to this. So I hung on to automatic pistol. I hung on to it for my stay there. My oldest granddaughter got the keys to the gun cabinet, and I went and inspected their supply. By the way, my daughter and son-in-law have been calling this gun cabinet a gun safe. It wasn't a gun safe. It was a glass-fronted cabinet. And so my son-in-law and daughter were agreeable. I told them, you're less safe with this weapon. And he nodded his head in agreement. They had no problem with me hanging on to that gun.
Okay.
I gave it back when I got on the plane and came back here in New York. My 89-year-old father used to be a member of the NRA. He no longer is. He won't. I grew up learning how to hunt. You're trained in New York State on gun safety.
But John, let me jump in here, John, because first of all, I want to thank you for sharing that story about your daughter, and I know that that can be a very difficult thing to kind of wade through, safety. I'm not sure that people like Paul Simonelli would argue that in that case a gun does make the house safer. I don't know, because I think one of the things Paul has contended is, you know, gun owners tend to be very well trained and respectful, and that Paul believes generally more guns makes people safer. I don't want to speak for you, Paul, but in this case, is this a dad making a good decision, and does this add any insight to this case, to this story?
I'm not sure that it does. He took it away for a brief period of time. He returned it, and I guess the end of the story is that they're surviving in Florida in their circumstance.
Are there moments you think, Paul, that the presence of guns makes people unsafe?
In the hands of people that shouldn't have them, yes, I agree with you. Of course, I agree. We may have a different definition on who should not have them, but yes, if someone has them that shouldn't have them, and there are people that should not have them, and I'll be the first one to tell you, I prosecuted a lot of people in my time in the district attorney's office for possessing firearms illegally and using them illegally, and I have absolutely no reservation with holding those folks accountable. I think we just have to be very, very careful that we don't make the law so restrictive, much like what we've done with some of the areas of the SAFE Act, where otherwise law-abiding people have adversely had to affect their lives to stay in compliance with a law that is really doing nothing to protect or help anybody. And I think that's the biggest concern. You know, we came in today to talk about this National Reciprocity Act. We have a model in place right now, and it's been working for 14 or 15 years and throughout the country. And I don't know that there's any reported uses by the folks under this model of doing something illegally or improper. And that's
what's the model?
H.R. 218 that allows retired police officers that qualify on an annual basis and meet the standards within their state and their department qualification-wise annually to carry a concealed firearm anywhere in the United States. There's limitations on that. For instance, if someone was coming from Pennsylvania, they'd have to comply with New York's ammunition restrictions. But once again, the model exists. And we're not talking about someone who was a police officer last year. Someone can become a police officer when they're 20 years old, 21 years old. They can retire with 20 years. So they could have retired when they were 40, 41, and they could be 70 right now and still meeting that standard. So the mere fact that they were a police officer 30 years ago does not, I think, change that, you know, make them any more qualified or otherwise. But there is a requirement that if they are going to carry, they have to meet the minimum standard in their state or for their department to do so. And, you know, and a few other administrative things, left the department in good standing and other things. That model's working. That's putting more people out there in a position to help if something goes wrong. That was the underpinning of that legislation.
But those are retired police officers. I trust Gary Putup more than me if we're in a situation where something is going down.
How many years ago did you retire?
Actually, I'll tell you what, I take a little bit of offense at that, and I think every retired police officer would. To compare someone like me who had 20 to 30 years of training.
Well, I had 30 years in the military.
Supervision, understanding the law. To compare me with somebody that walks into Walmart and buys a gun with no, you know, with no training at all, I'm sorry, that's a little, that analogy is false.
I don't think it is.
Give him
10 seconds to respond to that.
Someone who's removed 25 or 30 years from their law enforcement background has no better skill, is no better prepared.
Now, Paul,
you may not be.
I haven't played poker seriously in 12 years. I am a way better poker player than you, unless you have played seriously, and it's been 12 years for me.
Paul, I don't know if
you
know this.
But there's
skills you pick up.
Wait a minute. There's other people in this country besides police officers. I spent 30 years in the military. There's 9.6 million veterans in the United States
that may have
extensive. Police don't qualify that often. A police officer qualifies.
Well, I don't know if you realize this, but under 218, you have to undergo a class and qualify
every year. And I'm saying that's a
all
good
right?
model.
Which is,
I think that's a that, great model.
Right. The other thing is, no offense to you, but as military, but being in the military is not the same as being a police officer.
It depends what you did in the military.
Even if you were a military police officer, you're not enforcing state and local laws. There's quite a bit of difference between military and police. And that's no disrespect. It's just that they're different. But again, according to the bill, the model you're talking about requires that a police officer, once he's retired, still has to attend training classes and qualifications. That's just
right.
A bad analogy.
I said it's a great model. That's what I said. It's a great model.
And Paul also said earlier, Gary, that he thinks the current concealed carry reciprocity legislation is flawed. Is this one way to improve it?
Right. I think
to give it annual training requirements.
I think there has to be a baseline because of the situation I understand that people that are the right of me might not agree with me on this, but if you're a responsible gun owner, the thought of whether it's recertifying or retraining, it's a losable skill. You can't. It's not like riding a bike. You just can't hop on it and do it the way you had intended to do it. And if you don't practice, if you're not responsible in your ownership, then carrying a gun is more of a liability than it is an asset. So
I think certainly we're agreed, and I think Paul and I think we all agree, and I agree with Paul. That's the problem. One of the flaws that we see with this particular bill.
Okay, I want to get back to your phone calls. John in Webster is next up. Go ahead, John. Thanks.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. Up front, I'll say I don't see the necessity of civilians carrying concealed weapons. I think the only people who should be able to carry concealed weapons are police officers, off-duty police officers, and retired police officers. And I'll tell you something. I outed myself to the local newspaper here in Webster a few months ago. I've had two careers, Evan. And you know the second one, right? I taught philosophy. My first career was with the federal government. I was an undercover agent for the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. We later were blended into the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. And then from there, we were put into the DEA. And sometime in that, I went to work in the Attorney General's office as an investigator. I just don't see the necessity for people to carry concealed weapons. In my years, if someone had a gun, he was considered a bad guy. If we were patting him down, or if he displayed a weapon, he might be shot. Today, cops don't know that. They could be patting someone down and find a weapon on him, and the guy says, well, I have a... Oh, yes, I forgot that I had it, or whatever. But I just don't see the need for civilians,
all right,
people to have them.
John, thank you, as always. I appreciate the phone call. We're down to our last 3 minutes, so I know that Paul Simonelli disagrees with that, but let me ask Gary and Chiron, do you think there should be concealed carry at all? Because what this law would do would be open up states to the least restrictive concealed carry laws to respect other states' rights. Do you think concealed carry should be allowed in any state, Chiron?
Again, I think we agree on certain things, that we all agree that responsible owners, and that should be defined by the states, with some states require training, other states require local leadership to make an assessment using various factors to make that determination. We recognize that guns are a part of our culture. Do laws prevent all, you know, injury or deaths? We know that's not going to happen, but we know that laws will make a difference and that it'll keep a lot more of us safe. So we want to make sure that any laws that we are passing in this country and in our states should be thought through and be the best that we can do. And that requires engagement by everyone.
Sure, but you're not calling for the ending of concealed carry at all.
No, but we want to recognize that states are in the best position to make decisions for what works for them.
Listeners, if you remember, the reason we have this conversation is the concealed carry reciprocity bill that Congress is considering now would have states that have less or more restrictive gun laws have to honor the concealed carry laws of other states where they are less restrictive if people cross state lines. And so, Paul Simonelli, let me close by asking you this. you know, you've presented what the harm of the current situation is. I know you don't love the law that's being floated, but you like some of the ideas of it. And some of the harm you floated, you know, someone's driving all the way to Florida, they're passing through different states. In some states, they're fine. In some states, they're committing a felony. I don't know how much harm I see. I don't see people being prosecuted all that often for that. And I think we can live in a society where we tell people, you're going to be responsible. You're a gun owner. You better know the law. I don't care if you're driving to Antarctica. You have to know if the gun is allowed to be on you or in a locked, opaque case in your trunk. And if you don't know that, that's on you. I mean, I'm sort of a personal responsibility guy there. But is this an effort towards concealed carry everywhere? You know, in other words, is this a kind of Trojan horse to get concealed carry in all states with all the same, the least possible restrictions?
I guess what I would say to you is what I started with. In 38 states right now, it's not an issue. There's a way to conceal carry no matter where you live. If you live in New York, you can, and if I wanted to do a little more paperwork, I could probably get that up to 41 or 42 states, I could conceal carry. So it's happening every day right now. People are doing it. It's really just for a very small number of states that it's are going to be negatively impacted. Just like the tax legislation that just passed is going to negatively impact New York and California because we have such high property taxes and high income taxes, state income taxes. It's affecting us more than it is other people. So I don't know that it's as big a deal. I think it's flawed the way it's written right now, but I think there is a place for clarifying what the rules are.
Paul Simonelli is managing member of the Simonelli & Simonelli Law Firm. Thank you for being here, Paul. As always, good to have you. And there was a good amount of agreement on certain issues. Chiron Sattler-LeBlanc, who's local chapter leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, thank you for being here.
Again, thanks for a great conversation.
And Gary Putup, representative of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Paul.
Listeners, we've got Governor Cuomo's budget address in 90 seconds. You're going to hear it live in the 1 o'clock hour.